Disc 4.
When at last the first grey tinge of dawn appeared, the Wills were still doggedly astern of the Caird. And there was land, too, great black headlands appearing through the mists, scarcely a quarter of a mile away. Immediately, Shackleton ordered them to put about and head west across the wind, and in the space of 15 minutes, possibly less, the wind suddenly eased off. They had passed the northeast tip of the island, and they were under the lee of the land at last. But there was no sign of a landing place, not even the smallest cove or beach. There was ice, though. Large pieces of glaciers that had tumbled into the water floated on the surface. The men snatched up small chunks and thrust them into their mouths. For nearly an hour they searched the shoreline for a foothold, however small. Then somebody spied a tiny, shingled beach, half hidden behind a chain of rocks. Shackleton ordered the boats to make for it. When they were 1,000 yards off, Shackleton signalled the Wills to come alongside and take him on board. Of the two boats, she had a shallower draught, and Shackleton wanted to approach the beach first to see if the Caird could negotiate the seething channel between the rocks. At that exact moment, the docker was driving westward along the coast, looking for a place to land. Since sunrise, they had gone 14 miles past point after point without seeing a single sight fit to beach the boat on. During all that distance, there had not been a glimpse of the other two boats, and it was now almost 9:30. The docker's crew were sure that they alone had survived the night. "Poor blighters," Greenstreet whispered to Macklin. "They're gone." Then they rounded a tiny spit of land, and there, dead ahead, were the masts of the Caird and Wills. By some incredible coincidence, the docker's inability to find a suitable place to land had reunited her with the rest of the party. Had there been a haven somewhere in those 14 miles behind her, the two groups might now have been miles apart, each assuming the other had been lost. The men aboard the docker gave 3 hoarse cheers to their shipmates, but the noise of the breakers drowned them out. A few minutes later, Shackleton looked up and saw the docker bearing down upon them. By then the Wills was close inshore. A shallow reef lay across the opening, and heavy rollers foamed over it. Shackleton waited for his moment, then gave the order to pull, and the Wills rolled safely over the reef. With the next wave, her bow ground against the shore. Shackleton, remembering his promise, urged Blackborough to jump ashore, but the lad failed to move. Impatiently, Shackleton took hold of him and lifted him over the side. Blackborough dropped to his hands and knees, then rolled over and sat down with the surf surging around him.
"Get up!"
Shackleton ordered. Blackborough looked up. "I can't, sir." Shackleton suddenly remembered Blackborough's feet. In the excitement of landing, he'd forgotten, and he felt ashamed. Howe and Bakewell jumped overboard and pulled Blackborough farther up the beach. The stores were rapidly unloaded, and the Wills was rowed out to the docker. Stores and men were transferred and ferried ashore. Then the Caird was unloaded enough so she could negotiate the reef. As the boats were being pulled to safety, Rickinson suddenly turned pale and a minute later collapsed of a heart attack. Greenstreet's frostbitten feet would hardly support him, and he hobbled ashore and lay down alongside Blackborough. Hudson pulled himself through the surf, then sank down on the beach. Stevenson, a vacant expression on his face, was helped ashore, out of the reach of the water. They were on land. It was the merest handhold, 100 feet wide and 50 feet deep. A meagre grip on a savage coast, exposed to the full fury of the subantarctic ocean. But no matter. For the first time in 497 days, they were on land, solid, unsinkable, immovable, blessed land. Many of the men half stumbled about aimlessly, scuffling their feet in the pebbles or bending down to pick up a handful of rocks. Some even dropped full length to the ground to feel its sublime solidity beneath them. For a time, a few men simply sat down, shivering uncontrollably and mumbling gibberish to themselves. Just then the sun came out. In its light, their faces showed dead white from exhaustion and frostbite, and from being continually soaked with water. The circles around their eyes were so deep, their eyes seemed to have sunk slightly into their heads. Green readied some milk as quickly as he could, and each man's mug was filled. They drank it almost boiling hot, and its heat spread throughout their bodies, setting their nerves to tingling as if their blood had suddenly been thawed and begun to flow again. Shackleton stood in the centre of the group. He'd removed his helmet, and his long, uncut hair hung down over his forehead. His shoulders were bent with care, and his voice was so hoarse from shouting that he was unable to speak above a whisper. Yet he felt a profound sense of satisfaction and accomplishment, to be standing at last on land, surrounded by his men. The men themselves spoke very little. Each seemed absorbed in his own thoughts. When they finished their milk, a party was sent to bring in some seals. They brought back four, which were immediately stripped of blubber and cut into thick steaks. Green set to work frying up all the steaks his pots could hold, while the rest of the men pitched the tents. Finally, the food was ready, and they ate. It was neither breakfast, nor lunch, nor dinner. It was one long, intermittent meal. As soon as they had finished the first round of steaks, Green put more on the fire. When these were ready, the men stopped whatever they were doing and ate again. It wasn't until nearly 3 p.m. that they had eaten all they could hold. Then it was time to sleep. They unrolled their soaked sleeping bags and wrung out what water they could. The dampness that remained made little difference. James wrote, "Turned in and slept as we had never slept before, absolute dead, dreamless sleep, oblivious of wet sleeping bags, lulled by the croaking of the penguins." Shackleton permitted the man to sleep until 9:30 the next morning. But at breakfast an ugly rumour began to circulate, and when they'd finished eating, Shackleton confirmed the almost shocking truth of it. They would have to move. There could hardly have been a more demoralising prospect. Having barely escaped the sea's hungry grasp a scant 24 hours before, now to have to return to it. But the need was indisputable. They could see that only great good fortune had permitted them to land where they were. The cliffs at the head of the beach bore the marks of high tides and the scars of storm damage, indicating that the entire spit was frequently swept by seas. The place was obviously tenable only in good weather and while the tides were moderate. Shackleton ordered Wilde to take a crew of 5 seamen in the Wills and sail west along the coast to look for a more secure campsite. The Wills set out at 11 o'clock. The rest of the party worked at a leisurely pace throughout the day. The tents were struck, then pitched again as high up on the beach as a shelf could be found that would accommodate them. The stores were piled even higher in case of a sudden storm. They waited throughout the day for Wilde and his party to return, but darkness came, and there were still no signs of them. The other men ate supper and turned in, leaving the blubber stove burning to act as a beacon. Hardly had they fallen asleep when the watchman heard a shout from seaward. It was the returning Wills. All hands were roused and they went down to the water's edge. Wilde brought the Wills through the breakers and she was soon hauled well up onto the beach. Wilde and his 5 exhausted men confirmed the fact that this was truly an inhospitable place. In 9 hours of looking, they had found only one seemingly secure place to camp, a fairly sheltered spit of beach some 7 miles along the coast to the west. There was a good-sized penguin rookery there, Wilde said, and a nearby glacier would keep them supplied with ice for melting into water. Shackleton was satisfied, and he announced that they would break camp at dawn. The party was awakened at 5 a.m., and they ate their breakfast in the light from the blubber stove. When dawn came, it was clear and still. The tide came in very slowly, so it wasn't until 11 o'clock that there was enough water over the reef to get away. For the first 2 miles, the boats made fair progress. Then, with hardly an instant's warning, the elements seemed to go berserk. All at once the wind was shrieking in their ears, and the sea, which a moment before had been nearly calm, was torn into froth. They were caught in one of the violent downdrafts from the cliffs. Only by staying very close up against the land could the boats avoid being blown offshore. Their progress was creeping at best. Shortly after noon, the tide turned, and the current began to flow against them. They could gauge their progress against the land, and at times they seemed to be standing still. To hoist sail was unthinkable. They could only row. During the loading of the stores, Greenstreet had given his mittens to Clark to hold. But then, in the hurry to get away, Clark had gone off in the cared, leaving Greenstreet in the docker with nothing to protect his hands as he rowed. Now, his hands began to freeze. Frostbite blisters developed in his palms, and the water in them also froze. The blisters became like hard pebbles inserted into his flesh. Somewhat after 1 o'clock, when they'd covered half the distance to the new camp, they came to a towering rock protruding from the water about 1/4 mile offshore. The Caird, with Wild at the tiller, and the Wills under the command of Crean, made the obvious decision to pass inland of the rock. But Worsley, acting on one of his unpredictable impulses, elected to pass outside of it. The Wills and the Caird struggled on toward the beach, but the docker was lost from sight. By going to seaward of the rock, she had ventured too far offshore and been caught by the full violence of the wind. Worsley knew at once that he'd acted unwisely, and he swung the docker back toward the coast. "Put your backs into it!" he shouted at the rowers. But it was almost all the oarsmen could do to hold their own against the wind, and it was doubtful how much longer they could do even that. Worsley suddenly jumped up and shouted for Greenstreet to take the tiller. Then he took over Greenstreet's oar. Worsley was fresh, and he set a tremendous pace. Somehow, Macklin and Kerr, on the other oars, managed to keep up, and slowly they pulled their way closer to the rock and finally reached it. They'd gained a lee, only to be caught in the surge of the seas against the rock. "Back water! Back water!" Worsley screamed. They held her off, but only barely. 3 times the docker was lifted up and hurled toward the rock, but then the wind eased down momentarily, and they were able to pull clear. Greenstreet resumed his oar, and they continued toward the land. In the midst of the struggle, the mitten on Macklin's right hand had slipped off, and he saw now that his exposed fingers were turning white with frostbite. But he dared not stop rowing, even long enough to cover them. By now it was after 3 o'clock. The Caird and the Wills had landed safely. 2 seals found lying on the beach had been killed and stripped of blubber to start a fire. Shackleton stood looking for a glimpse of the docker. Finally, a speck appeared through the grey mists. It was the docker toiling into the wind toward the beach. The moment her bow touched, Greenstreet swung his numbed feet over the side and hobbled ashore through the surf. He spied the vapour rising from the freshly killed seals, stumbled toward where they lay, and thrust his frozen hands into their blood-warm bowels. Once more, they were all on land and safe. But the wondrous joy that had marked the landing only 30 hours before was absent now. An examination of the new campsite raised serious doubts about whether it had been worth the trouble to move. It was a rocky spit, about 30 yards across, extending to seaward like a tongue stuck out from an enormous glacier 150 yards inland. The spit rose steeply from the water, and its upper reaches appeared to be above the high-water mark, but otherwise it was completely naked. Except at the shoreline, there was not a boulder or even a small rock that might protect a man from the wind. "A more inhospitable place could scarcely be imagined," wrote Macklin. As the forecastle hands were setting up No. 4 tent, the wind got under it and ripped a 4-foot rent in its threadbare material. A few minutes later, No. 5 was caught by a blast of wind that very nearly tore it to shreds. The men made no effort to repair the tents. They simply spread the tent cloths as best they could and weighted them down with rocks. Then they spread out their sleeping bags which had been soaked anew during the trip in the boats, then lay down and fell asleep. Throughout the night, the wind continued to shriek down from the mountains. The men, who were sleeping on the ground, were slowly covered by an accumulation of snow, and by 4 o'clock everyone was sleeping on the ground because the tents had threatened to blow away and had to be taken down. The blizzard persisted throughout that day and into the next. Hardly a man stirred from the meagre protection of his sleeping bag until 11 a.m, when Shackleton ordered all hands out to kill penguins. There were about 200 penguins altogether, and of that number they managed to secure a total of 77. Skinning them with their already partially frostbitten hands was painful work, Audley's wrote. For to bare the hand for a very few minutes in such a blizzard means almost certain frostbite. We sought shelter as we could find, but it was only the warmth of the dead penguins that saved our hands. Shackleton finally made official what everyone had expected for a long time. He would take a party of 5 men and set sail in the Caird for South Georgia to bring relief. They would leave as soon as the Caird could be made ready and provisioned for the trip. The news came as no surprise to anyone. The subject had been discussed openly, even long before the party had left Patience Camp. They knew that whatever island they might ultimately reach, a boat journey of some sort would be necessary to bring rescue to the party as a whole. Though the Caird's chances of actually reaching South Georgia were remote, a great many men genuinely wanted to be taken along. The prospect of staying behind, of waiting and not knowing, of possibly wintering on this hateful island, was far from attractive. Shackleton had already made up his mind, after long discussions with Wilde, not only as to who should be taken, but who should not be left behind. Worsley would be indispensable. They would travel perhaps 1,000 miles across the stormiest ocean on the globe. The ultimate goal was an island no more than 25 miles wide at its widest point. To guide an open boat that distance, and then to strike a pinpoint on the chart, was a task that would sorely tax even Worsley's skill as a navigator. After him, Shackleton chose Crean, McNeish, Vincent, and McCarthy. Crean was tough, a seasoned sailor who did as he was told, and Shackleton was not sure that Crean's rough, tactless nature would lend itself well to a period of enforced, and perhaps long, waiting. McNeish was now 57 years old, and really not up to the journey, but both Shackleton and Wilde felt that he was still a potential troublemaker, and not a good man to be left behind. Jack Vincent bore the same stigma as McNeish. His compatibility under trying conditions was open to doubt, and he might fare badly if left behind. On the positive side, he had behaved well during the journey from Patience Camp, and his simple strength was in his favour. By contrast, Timothy McCarthy had never caused anyone a moment's trouble, and he was universally liked. Shackleton picked him for no more complicated reasons than that he was an experienced seaman and that he was built like a bull. As soon as Shackleton made the decision official, McNeish and Marston went to work removing the planks that had been added to the docker in order to fashion a sort of decking over the Caird. The rest of the men were busy trying to create some degree of comfort. A new shelter was made for the galley out of packing cases, rocks, and some pieces of canvas. Because of the physical conditions of Blackborough and Rickenson, who was still weak from his heart attack, Shackleton granted permission for the docker to be upended, to form a shelter for the members of No. 5 tent. The men did what they could to make the shelter weatherproof by packing snow and mud along one side, and draping blankets, coats, and odd bits of canvas from the other. But nothing could be done to dry the ground beneath, which was a stinking mess of melted snow in which penguin guano had dissolved. The discomfort was so intense that sleeping was almost impossible. The blizzard had continued 3 days and nights. The winds had driven the dust-like snow into everything, even to the very foot of their sleeping bags. The strength of the wind made it perilous at times, even to venture outside. In spite of these miserable conditions, the work of preparing the cairn for her journey went on the following day. McNeish, Marston and MacLeod attached the runners of a dismantled sledge across the upper sides of the boat to form a framework for decking her over. Pieces of plywood from the cases of stores were nailed over these, and a canvas covering of sorts was begun. The mainmast was removed from the docker and lashed inside the cairn's keel in the hope that she would not break in two when she encountered bad weather. Greenstreet's frostbitten hands had recovered somewhat, and he and Bakewell were given the job of providing the cairn with ballast. Together, they sewed shale into canvas sacks, about 100 pounds to each sack. The canvas was frozen, and they had to thaw it out, a foot at a time, by holding it close to the blubber stove. The heat and the rough stones caused the frostbite blisters in Greenstreet's hands to break and then bleed. The next day the blizzard rose to new heights. All work, except the simplest cooking, was out of the question, and the men stayed in their sleeping bags all day. Wilde predicted that if conditions didn't improve shortly, some of the weaker men would not survive. And Shackleton met, secretly, with Macklin to ask how long he thought the men who were remaining behind could hold out under such conditions. Macklin said he thought about a month. Shackleton spent the day supervising the various activities. He saw that the cairn was very nearly finished, and announced that she would sail as soon as the weather permitted. He spent almost the whole night talking with Wilde about 100 different subjects, ranging from what should be done in the event that a rescue party failed to arrive within a reasonable length of time, to the distribution of tobacco. When there was nothing more to discuss, Shackleton wrote a letter in his log, which he left with Frank Wilde. April 23, 1916. Elephant Island. Dear Sir, in the event of my not surviving the boat journey to South Georgia, you will do your best for the rescue of the remaining party. You are in full command from the time the boat leaves this island, and all hands are under your orders. On your return to England, you are to communicate with the committee. I wish you, Lees, and Hurley to write the book. You watch my interests. In another letter, you will find the terms as agreed for lecturing. You to do England, Great Britain, and the Continent. Hurley, the USA. I have every confidence in you, and always have had. May God prosper your work and your life. You can convey my love to my people, and say, I tried my best. Yours sincerely, E. H. Shackleton. Throughout the night, the successive watchmen kept a lookout for a break in the weather. It came during the very early morning hours. The wind moderated considerably. Shackleton ordered that all hands be called at the first streak of light. The men were turned out just before 6 a.m. The cared party was to take a 6 weeks' supply of food, consisting of 3 cases of sledging ration, 2 cases of nut food, a supply of biscuits, and powdered milk and bouillon cubes to provide the party with hot drinks. The cooking would be done on a Primus stove, and 2 were to be taken, so they would have a spare. What little extra clothing could be found in the way of socks and mittens was rounded up, along with 6 sleeping bags. Worsley had gathered together all the navigational aids he could find. He took his own sextant and another which belonged to Hudson, along with the necessary navigational tables and what charts were to be had. These were packed into a box that was made as watertight as possible. He still carried his sole chronometer around his neck. Out of 24 on board the Endurance when she sailed from England, this one alone had survived. A farewell breakfast was prepared, for which Shackleton permitted 2 extra biscuits and 1/4 pound of jam per man. For the most part, the men stood around joking, but the tension in the air was unmistakable. Both groups knew they might never see one another again. Toward 9 o'clock, Shackleton went with Worsley up to the lookout point to survey the ice conditions offshore. They saw a band of floes parallel to the coast about 6 miles out, but there was an opening through which the cairn could pass easily. They returned to camp and found that the boat was ready. All hands were mustered to launch her. The Caird was paddled out past the reef, and she waited at the end of her bowline while the Wills was launched and loaded with about half a ton of ballast. This cargo was rowed out and transferred to the Caird. On her second trip, the Wills took out another quarter ton of ballast sacks and an extra 500 pounds of large rocks. Shackleton was now ready to go. He had spoken to Wilde for the last time, and the two had shaken hands. The provisions were placed on board the Wills, and Shackleton and Vincent climbed aboard, and she pulled away from the beach. "Good luck, boss," the shore party called after him. Shackleton swung around and waved briefly. When they reached the Caird, Shackleton and Vincent jumped on board, and the stores were rapidly passed across. Finally, the two crews leaned across and shook hands. Again, there were several nervous jokes. Then the Wills let go and headed for the beach. The Caird caught the wind, and Worsley at the helm swung her bow toward the north. Ord Lees recorded, "We watched them until they were out of sight," which was not long, for such a tiny boat was soon lost to sight on the great heaving ocean. As she dipped into the trough of each wave, she disappeared completely, sail and all. For the 22 men who turned their faces inland, the excitement was past, and the trial by patience had begun. Their helplessness was almost total, and they knew it. The Caird had sailed, taking the best of everything they had. After a while, they pulled the Wills farther up onto the beach, then turned her over and crawled underneath. "As we sat there, cramped, crowded and wet," wrote Macklin, "we wondered how we were going to face the month ahead of us, which was the very least we could hope for before relief." And this, he admitted, was a most optimistic expectation, based upon a half-dozen assumptions, the first among them being that the Caird would actually get through. Supper was served early, and the men turned in almost immediately. They awoke the following morning to a bleak, forbidding day of half-mist, half-snow. The bad weather only made it the more imperative that some sort of shelter be devised. Greenstreet and Marston suggested that the boats might be inverted to form the roof of a hut, and Wilde agreed. They began to collect rocks to build a foundation. It was exhausting toil. When the foundation walls were about 4 feet high, the boats were placed on top, side by side. The few scraps of wood that remained were laid across the upended boats from keel to keel, and a tent was stretched over the whole affair. Its ropes were anchored at each side to serve as guys. As a final touch, pieces of canvas were lashed around the foundation so that the wind might not find its way between the stones. There was a gap in the foundation on the shoreward side to serve as an entrance, and two overlapping blankets were hung there to keep the weather out. At last, Wilde pronounced the hut ready for occupancy, and the men gathered up their sodden sleeping bags and crawled inside. They were allowed to select whatever spot they wanted, and some men immediately crawled up into the upper story formed by the inverted seats of the boats. Other men took positions on the ground, wherever it looked the snuggest, or the driest, or the warmest. Supper was issued at 4:45 p.m., and the men wearily crawled into their bags the moment they had eaten. For the first several hours they lay in dreamless, exhausted sleep, but shortly after midnight a new blizzard blew up, and from then until dawn their sleep was fitful at best. The gale, screaming down from the peaks inland, shook the hut, and it seemed that each new gust would knock the boats off their foundations. And the force of the wind penetrated every chink, so that snow whistled in through a thousand tiny openings. But somehow, when dawn came, the shelter was still intact. Little by little, as the wind revealed the vulnerable spots, they sealed them up, and each day the shelter became just a little more livable. During the day, enough light filtered through the canvas roofing so that the men could make their way about, but long before dusk, the hut grew much too dark to see anything. Marston and Hurley found that by filling a small container with blubber oil and draping pieces of surgical bandages over the edge as a wick, they could obtain a feeble flame by which a man might read if he were not more than a few feet away. By such methods, they gradually eliminated one little misery after another. At last, on May the 2nd, 8 days after the Caird had sailed, and more than 2 weeks after their arrival, the sun came out. The men hurriedly carried their sleeping bags outside to spread them out to dry. It was clear again on the 3rd and on the 4th. Even after 3 days of sunshine, their sleeping bags were not completely dry, though the improvement was notable. There were lengthy debates about how long it would take the Caird to reach South Georgia, and how long after that it would be before a rescue ship arrived. The most optimistic figure was that by May the 12th, a week hence, they might expect to see a ship. More conservative guesses said that it would be June the 1st before there could be any thought of rescue. There was plenty to keep them occupied, though they worked with one eye kept to seaward. There were penguins to be killed, and once in a while a seal, and there was ice to be gathered for water. Macklin and McElroy were kept busy with patients. Kerr developed a bad tooth, and Macklin had to pull it for him. Wordy's hands became infected, and Holness was troubled with a sty. Rickinson was slowly recovering from his heart attack, but the saltwater boils on his wrists stubbornly refused to heal. Greenstreet's feet, which had been frostbitten in the boats, did not improve, and he was confined to his sleeping bag. Hudson seemed in a serious way. His hands showed definite signs of healing, but the pain in his left buttock, which had begun in the boats, had developed into a very large abscess which pained him constantly. The most serious invalid was Blackborough. His right foot appeared to be recovering, and there was hope that it might be saved, but in the toes of his left foot, gangrene had already set in. More and more, as the days wore on, they fell inescapably into the routine of their existence. Each evening, before supper, they would take one final long look seaward to make certain that the dark shape of a ship or a wisp of smoke on the horizon had not been overlooked. But when they had satisfied themselves that no relief vessel was to be seen, they would go into the hut for supper. Afterward, Hussey would often play banjo for a time, but the short period in the evening, before the blubber lamps were extinguished, was devoted mostly to talk. Almost anything could serve as a topic of conversation or debate, though their rescue was the primary subject, with food running a close second. Through one means or another, they kept their spirits up, mostly by building dreams. But each day the ever-shortening hours of daylight told of the approach of winter. The sun now rose a little after 9 o'clock, and set about 3 p.m. Since they were more than 300 miles north of the Antarctic Circle, they did not have to face the prospect of the sun disappearing altogether, but the weather was becoming increasingly cold. The realization was spreading that, logically at least, a rescue before winter was becoming increasingly improbable, if not impossible. On May the 25th, 1 month and 1 day after the Caird had sailed, Hurley wrote, "Weather, drifting snow and wind from east. Our wintry environment embodies the most inhospitable and desolate prospect imaginable. All are resigned now and fully anticipating wintering." "Every morning," Macklin wrote on June the 6th, "I go to the top of the hill, and in spite of everything, I cannot help hoping to see a ship coming along to our relief." And though day after day no ship appeared, they attributed it to a dozen different reasons: the ice, the gales, the fog, arrangements for getting a proper ship, official delays. And all or any of these factors combined, there was almost never any mention of the most probable reason of all: the Caird had been lost. In an entry notable for its candour, Ord Lees wrote, "One cannot help but be a bit anxious about Sir Ernest. One wonders how he fared, where he is now, and how it is that he's not yet been able to relieve us. The subject is practically taboo. Everyone keeps their own counsel and thinks different. And no one knows just what anyone else thinks about it. And it's quite obvious that no one really dare say what they really do think. But whatever each of them might think, there was nothing to do but to wait and hope. Each day one man took his turn as stoker, and it was his duty to tend the fire all day. There was also the job of outside Peggy, which entailed bringing in ice for water and gathering the necessary supplies of frozen meat to be cooked. Both tasks were tedious, and there was a fair amount of trading in order to escape them. Half a penguin steak would usually buy the services of a substitute stoker for one day. There was also a good deal of bartering in the matter of rations, and several food pools were formed. Typical of these was the sugar pool, in which each man passed up one of his three lumps of sugar each day in order to partake of a feast when his turn came around every sixth or seventh day. Wilde made no objection to this sort of thing. In fact, he permitted a wide range of flexibility in most matters. It served to avoid friction, and it gave the men something to occupy their minds. There was, on the whole, an astounding absence of serious antagonisms, considering the conditions under which they were attempting to exist. Possibly it was because they were in a state of almost perpetual minor friction. Arguments rambled on the whole day through, and they served to let off a great deal of steam which might otherwise have built up. In addition, the party had been reduced to an almost classless society, in which most of them felt free to speak their minds, and did. A man who stepped on another man's head, trying to find his way out at night, was treated to the same abuse as any other, regardless of what his station might once have been. This matter of going outside at night to relieve themselves was possibly the most disagreeable aspect of their existence. It was almost physically impossible to avoid stepping on somebody somewhere. Then came the crawl through the hut entrance and out into the weather, which often approached blizzard conditions. Pieces of rock and bits of ice flew unseen through the blackness. Rather than face such a prospect, the men came to practice bladder control to the limits of bodily endurance. After a time, Wilde succumbed to mounting pressure, and a 2-gallon fuel can was made into a urinal for use at night. The rule was that the man who raised its level to within 2 inches of the top had to carry the can outside and empty it. If a man felt the need and the weather outside was bad, he would lie awake waiting for somebody else to go so that he might judge from the sound the level of the can's contents. If it sounded ominously close to the top, he would try to hold out until morning. More than once, a man would fill the can as silently as possible, then steal back into his sleeping bag. The next man to get up would find to his fury that the can was full, and had to be emptied before it could be used. The unfortunate victim, however, could expect very little sympathy. Most of the men looked on this as a kind of practical joke, and anyone who really lost his temper about it was so roundly ridiculed by the others that he soon gave it up. But there were definite fluctuations in morale, in accordance with the weather and whether the pack was in or out. Though the gales were fewer, there were long stretches of wet, gloomy weather, resulting in the kind of outlook Greenstreet recorded one evening. Everyone spent the day rotting in their bags, with blubber and tobacco smoke. So passes another goddamn rotten day. Throughout May, the more pessimistic members of the party, championed by Ord Lees, had predicted that one day the penguins would migrate and never be seen again until the end of the winter. Ord Lees felt so strongly, in fact, that he made a number of bets on the matter. Then one day, early in June, he lost 3, all at the same time. He had wagered, 1, that there would not be a single penguin on that day, 2, that no more than 10 would appear on any one day after June the 1st, and 3, that no more than 30 would be secured during the entire month. On that particular day, they killed 115. Food was thus not a cause for immediate concern, but there were other matters that needed attention, notably Blackborough's foot. A rescue, in time to get Blackburn to a hospital where the amputation might be done properly, was now obviously out of the question. The operation would have to take place on the next warm day. June the 15th dawned mild and misty. McElroy, after consulting with Wilde and Macklin, decided to proceed. Blackburn had long before resigned himself to the operation. What few surgical supplies they had were made ready, and as soon as breakfast was over, the hoosh pot was filled with ice, which was melted into water and brought to a boil to sterilise the instruments. A number of packing cases were placed side by side, close to the stove, and covered with blankets to serve as an operating table. Blackborough was lifted onto the operating table. Every available blubber lamp was lighted, and the dingy interior of the hut grew fairly light in the little circle around the stove. When it was warm enough, McElroy and Macklin stripped to their undershirts, the cleanest garments they had. The anaesthetic was to be chloroform, not a very good anaesthetic, especially close to an open fire. But it was all they had, and there were only 6 ounces of that. Macklin uncorked the bottle of chloroform and poured a small amount onto a piece of surgical gauze. Then he patted Blackborough's shoulder reassuringly and held the gauze across his face. He instructed Blackborough to close his eyes and breathe deeply, and Blackborough obediently did as he was told. Within 5 minutes, he was unconscious, and Macklin nodded to McElroy that he could begin. Blackborough's foot was propped up and extended over the edge of the packing cases. A large, empty tin can was placed underneath. When the bandage was removed, the flesh of Blackborough's toes looked almost mummified, black and brittle. Wilde removed a scalpel from the hooshpot steriliser and handed it to McElroy. McElroy cut across the end of Blackborough's foot, then peeled the skin back. He asked for a pair of forceps, and Wilde removed them from the boiling water. Carefully, McElroy reached well up under the flap of skin to where the toes joined the foot. Then, one at a time, he cut them off. Each dropped with a metallic clatter into the empty tin can below. Next, McElroy meticulously scraped away the dead, blackened flesh, and when the wound was clean, he carefully stitched it up. Finally, it was done. Blackborough's foot had been neatly trimmed off just at the ball joint. Altogether, it had taken 55 minutes. Before long, Blackborough began to moan, and in a little while he opened his eyes. He was groggy for a time, but then he smiled up at the two doctors. "I'd like a cigarette," he said. So McElroy tore a page out of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, rubbed up some plug tobacco, and rolled a cigarette for his patient. One by one, the wearisome days crept by. There was only one high point, Midwinter's Day on June the 22nd. They celebrated it with a hearty breakfast in the morning and a marvellous nut-food pudding for supper. Afterward, as they lay in their sleeping bags, a lively programme of 26 different acts was presented. Many of the men had worked for days on the topical verses they would present, and it turned out most of the barbs were directed toward Green and Aud Lees. Hussey played the banjo, and second engineer Kerr, as he had a year before on the Endurance, sang Spagoni the Toreador, especially out of key to oblige. James the physicist, however, delivered the song of the evening. "My name is Frankie Wildo, my hut's on Elephant Isle, the walls without a single brick, the roof's without a tile. But nevertheless you must confess, for many and many a mile, it's the most palatial dwelling place you'll find on Elephant Isle." The evening ended with a toast to the sun's return, and the boss, and the crew of the Caird. With the passage of Midwinter's Day, there was no longer any definite event to look forward to, nothing but the interminable waiting and wondering. Aud Lees wrote, "Wilde is always saying that the ship will be here next week, but of course he says this just to keep up the spirits of those who are likely to become despondent. He says that he will not get uneasy about Sir Ernest until the middle of August." This, then, became the target date, the time when they might begin to worry officially. Wilde purposely made it as remote as he reasonably could to keep their hopes alive as long as possible. But it was far from easy. Little by little, conditions were becoming increasingly primitive. The treasured nut food had been finished, and the powdered milk, too. And though these were sorely missed, their lack could hardly be compared with the tragedy when the tobacco finally ran out. It did not happen all at once. Some men had been more frugal with their ration than others, who had gone ahead and smoked up their allotment in the belief that they would not be marooned for more than a month or so. Jock Wordy, with typical Scottish thrift, had stretched his supply so that he was the last man to run out, and during the week or so when his small hoard was all that remained, he found himself the centre of almost ceaseless bargaining. In time, even his supply was exhausted, and there followed a period of depression that amounted almost to mourning. But the desire to smoke was so strong that before long experiments were begun to find a substitute. MacLeod started it all by removing the sennegrass insulation from his boots, then filling his pipe with it. "The smell," wrote James, "is like that of a prairie fire rather than of tobacco." Nevertheless, the habit caught on, and soon a good many men were smoking sennegrass. "Lichen has also been tried," James continued, "and we live in fear that someone will start on seaweed." Over the months, the interior of the hut had become filthy to the point of squalor. Indeed, they usually referred to it as the sty or the snuggery. When they could, they brought in fresh stones to cover the floor, but a great deal of the time the only available stones outside were frozen in place. In the subterranean gloom inside the place, small pieces of food had dropped unnoticed onto the floor, and now, with the combination of water and heat, the food began to rot, contributing yet one more disagreeable odour. Near the end of July, the abscess on Hudson's buttock had grown to the size of a football. McElroy disliked the idea of opening it because of the risk of infection, but Hudson was in such severe pain that it had to be done. McElroy finally performed the operation without an anaesthetic and removed more than 2 pints of foul-smelling liquid. "It's hard to realise one's position here," Macklin wrote, "living in a smoky, dirty, ramshackle little hut, with only just sufficient room to cram us all in, drinking out of a common pot, and laying in close proximity to a man with a large discharging abscess. A horrible existence. But yet we're pretty happy." As July drew to a close, the feeling of anxiety so long suppressed became increasingly difficult to fight back. Hurley wrote on the 30th, "Today seems to be particularly monotonous. If there were only some duties, useful or otherwise, to be performed, the burden of time would be more pleasant, and at present our sole exercise is to promenade up and down the 80 yards of the spit, or climb to the lookout and scan the misty skyline for a mast. We look forward anxiously to the forthcoming month when relief is anticipated. One grows weary of continually estimating the days from the Caird's departure to the hoped-for arrival of the relief ship." Though they were still hesitant to suggest openly that the Caird could be lost, they could no longer avoid admitting, at least tacitly, that something quite possibly might have happened. Shackleton had been gone for 99 days, and there was a kind of creeping awareness that they might be watching for something that would never come. If so, Macklin finally conceded in his diary on July the 31st, "it means a journey in the Stancomb Wills to Deception Island. This will be an arduous journey, but I hope I will be picked as one of the party if it comes to this." For such a journey, they were desperately short of equipment. The only sail remaining was the Will's ridiculous little jib, so they would have to contrive some sort of mainsail out of sewn-together pieces of the rotten tent cloths. There was not even a mast from which it might be hoisted. The mast from the Will's had been taken to make a mizzenmast for the Caird, and the dockers had been sacrificed to strengthen the Caird's keel. But something probably could be done with the 5 oars they still had. On August the 13th, James wrote, "beginning to look anxiously for the ship. This is about the time." August the 16th, Macklin, "eagerly on the lookout for the relief ship, and most of us go up the hill and eagerly scan the horizon for any sign of her. Some of the party have quite given up all hope of her coming." And on August the 19th, Ord Lees wrote, "there is no good in deceiving ourselves any longer." McNeish's Log, Monday, April the 24th. "We took goodbye with our companions and set sail on our 870 miles to South Georgia for assistance at 12:30. And at 2 p.m. we came to a stream of ice which we managed to get through in about an hour. Then we were in the open sea, wet through, but happy through it all." The little group of dark figures waving goodbye were silhouetted against the white snow, and they made a pathetic picture from the cad as she lifted to the increasing swell. Worsley held her on a northerly course, and Shackleton stood beside him, alternately peering ahead at the approaching ice, and turning again to look at the men he was leaving behind. It was only a short time, it seemed, until they were no longer discernible. It was just 2 o'clock when the cairn reached the ice, which proved to be a thick line of ancient floes that had been broken and melted into a myriad of different shapes. Worsley tried to steer the boat safely amongst the lumps, but several times, turning to avoid one fragment, they bumped into another, and Shackleton decided they'd better row. The sails were dropped, and the men carefully crawled up onto the decking and put out their oars. After almost an hour, the ice began to thin out, and they soon came to the northern edge of the pack, then emerged once more into the open sea. The rowers happily scrambled back inside the cockpit, and everyone was enormously relieved. The wind had gradually swung around to the southeast, the perfect direction for driving them north. Shackleton ordered the sails set, and sent Crean, McNeish, Vincent and McCarthy forward to get some sleep, saying that he and Worsley would stay on duty throughout the night to watch for ice. When everything was squared away, Shackleton turned and looked astern. It was just possible to make out Elephant Island. A forbidding-looking place, certainly, but that only made it seem the more pitiful. It was the refuge of 22 men, who at that very moment were camped on a precarious, storm-washed spit of beach, as helpless and isolated from the outside world as if they were on another planet. Their plight was known only to the 6 men in this ridiculously little boat, whose responsibility now was to prove that all the laws of chance were wrong, and return with help. It was a staggering trust. The 2 men sat side by side, Worsley steering and Shackleton huddled close up against him. Their primary concern was ice, and Shackleton and Worsley kept a sharp lookout. From time to time, Shackleton rolled cigarettes for both of them, and they spoke of many things. It was obvious that the burden of responsibility Shackleton had borne for 16 months had nibbled away somewhat at his enormous self-confidence. He confided to Worsley that the decision to separate the party had been a desperately difficult one, and he abhorred having to make it. But somebody had to go for help, and this was not the sort of responsibility which could be delegated to another person. As for the journey itself, he seemed strangely doubtful. He now faced an adversary so formidable that his own strength was nothing in comparison, and he did not enjoy being in a position where boldness and determination count for almost nothing, and in which victory is measured only in survival. To classify the dangers they faced in order of magnitude would have been impossible. But of the known threats, the greatest undoubtedly was ice, especially at night. One single collision with an unseen fragment could have ended the journey in a moment. Thus Shackleton's plan was to get north with all possible speed, before turning east toward South Georgia. And for the next 2 days they were lucky. The wind held steady out of the southwest, much of the time almost at gale force. By noon on April the 26th they had logged a total of 129 miles from Elephant Island, without encountering a sign of ice. However, those 2 days were an ordeal during which they were introduced, one at a time, to the endless miseries which constituted life on board the boat. There was the water, the all-pervading, inescapable water. Sometimes it was just a shower of spray, thrown up from the bow and flung astern by the wind, which caused no real suffering, except to the man at the helm. Much worse were the quieter, solid seas dipped up by the bow that poured aft and sloshed into the cockpit. And worst of all were the occasions when the boat plunged down just as a wave broke. Then green, foaming water rolled across the decking, splashed into the cockpit and drained down into the boat in icy streams through a score of openings in the canvas. Within 24 hours after leaving Elephant Island, the decking had begun to sag, so that there were a dozen pockets to hold the water. The man at the helm, of course, suffered the most, and each of them took his turn at the yoke lines for 1 hour and 20 minutes during each watch. But the other 2 men on duty were better off only by comparison. when they weren't baling or tending the sails or shifting ballast by moving the rocks in the bottom, they spent their time trying to avoid the streams coming from above. It was of little use, though. Invariably they wound up huddled over, with the water pouring off their backs. The boat had to be pumped out at fairly frequent intervals, usually two or three times each watch, and the job required two men, one to operate the plunger, while the other held the icy brass cylinder down into the water in the bottom of the boat. Even with mittens, the hands of the man gripping the cylinder would go numb within the space of 5 minutes, and they would trade places. Nor was the discomfort on board limited to the men on watch. They realised from the very beginning that even sleeping had a special brand of unpleasantness all of its own. The sleeping bags were located in the bow. To reach them involved a tortuous crawl on hands and knees over the rocks in the bottom. The closer a man got to the bow, the more restricted the space became, until finally he had to go down on his belly and slither forward, insinuating himself between the underside of the seats and the ballast. When at last he had reached the bow, there was the job of getting into his bag, then finally the problem of going to sleep. Fatigue helped, of course, but even so, the action of the boat in the bow was more violent than anywhere else. At times they were heaved bodily upwards, only to fall down onto the rocks again, or perhaps to be slammed from beneath as the boat was pitched aloft by a new wave. The Caird had been equipped with 6 sleeping bags, so that each man might have his own, but Shackleton soon suggested that they share 3 bags and use the others as mattresses to protect them from the rocks. Everyone quickly agreed. They had sailed from Elephant Island in rather high spirits, knowing that they were embarked at last for civilization, but after 2 days of uninterrupted misery, their cheeriness had worn away, and by noon on April the 26th, after Worsley had fixed the position at 128 miles from Elephant Island, the ordeal to which they were committed had become altogether too real. They were making progress at the agonizingly slow rate of about 1 mile every half hour or so. Only very occasionally did they think about South Georgia. It was so remote, so utopian, that it was almost depressing to contemplate. No man could have endured with just that to keep him going. Instead, life was reckoned in periods of a few hours, or possibly only a few minutes. An endless succession of trials leading to deliverance from the particular hell of the moment. When a man was awakened to go on watch, the focal point of his existence became that time 4 hours away when he could slither back into the cold, wet rockiness of the sleeping bag he was now leaving. Again and again the cycle was repeated until the body and the mind arrived at a state of numbness in which the frenzied antics of the boat, the perpetual cold and wet, came to be accepted almost as normal. At dawn on April the 28th, only a light northwest breeze was blowing. It was the best weather they'd had since leaving Elephant Island 4 days before. But there were dangerous signs of deterioration, both among the men and in their equipment. About mid-morning, McNeish suddenly sat down in the centre of the cockpit and peeled off his boots. His legs, ankles and feet were puffy and dead white, apparently from lack of exercise and from being continually soaked. When Shackleton saw the condition of McNeish's feet, he suggested that the other men remove their footgear, and they were all the same. Vincent was in far the worst condition, apparently suffering from rheumatism. The damage to Worsley's navigational books by the constant soaking was an even more serious problem. The destruction of these books could mean losing the way across this forsaken waste of ocean. And though every effort was made to protect them, they had to be taken out whenever a sight was taken. In the matter of taking sights, Worsley at first tried bracing himself inside the cockpit, but it was no good. To remain upright was difficult enough. To get an accurate reading was impossible. He found that it was best to kneel on the helmsman's seat, with Vincent and McCarthy holding him around the waist. Only once in the night was a positive check on the direction permitted, and then a flaming match was lighted so they could see the compass for a moment, to make certain that the wind was still out of the same quadrant. They had only 2 candles, which were being strictly preserved for that time that now seemed so far away, the landfall at South Georgia. The dawn of the fifth day, April the 29th, rose on a lumpy sea under a dull sky. Low, troubled clouds scudded past, almost touching the surface of the water. The wind was nearly dead astern, and the Caird laboured forward like a protesting old woman, being hurried along faster than she cared to go. Just before noon, a rift appeared in the sky, and Worsley hurriedly got his sextant. He was just in time, for a few minutes later the sun was gone. But Worsley had his sight, and Shackleton had recorded the chronometer reading. They had covered 238 miles since leaving Elephant Island 6 days before. They were almost one-third of the way. Throughout the day and into the night, the southwesterly wind continued growing ever stronger. By the time the bleak grey sky grew light on the morning of April the 30th, the surface of the sea was torn into foam, and the frenzied screech of the gale through the rigging rose and fell hysterically as the Caird was lifted to each successive swell. The temperature had dropped very close to zero, and the bitterness of the wind suggested that it was blowing straight off pack ice that was not very far away. Toward noon, the boat began to ice up. They pumped and bailed and beat the ice off her, all the while fighting to hold her stern up into the wind, but it was no use. The sea was more than she could take. Shackleton reluctantly gave the order to come about. The sails were dropped, and the sea anchor, a cone-shaped piece of canvas about 4 feet long, was put over on the end of a long bowline. It dragged through the water, and thus brought the Caird's bow up into the wind. Almost at once conditions improved. At least less water came on board. The boat, however, behaved like a thing possessed. She staggered drunkenly upward over each new wave, then plunged sideways, only to have her bow jerked violently around as she seized up on the sea anchor. It was not long before the furled sails started to collect ice, and with each burst of spray their load grew heavier. Within an hour they were frozen into a solid mass, and the action of the boat was growing sluggish as she began to get top-heavy. The sails had to be removed. So Crean and McCarthy were sent forward, and after knocking off the ice, they brought the sails below and stuffed them into the already crammed space under the decking. But then a heavy coating began to accumulate on the oars. There were four of them lashed against the shrouds. As the ice built up, they became like miniature bulwarks which prevented the water from spilling overboard before it froze. Shackleton watched anxiously, hoping that the load of ice on deck might not grow too heavy. But in the failing light of dusk he saw that it would be dangerous to let it go until morning. He ordered Worsley, Crean and McCarthy to go with him up onto the pitching deck. With great effort they clubbed the ice off the oars. By the time they were finished, it was dark and they were utterly drenched. They crept back into the cockpit, and the night began. Gradually, as the long hours of the night crept by, a subtle change could be detected in the boat. For one thing, the trickles of water through the decking became smaller, then finally ceased altogether. At the same time, her behaviour was growing noticeably less violent, and instead of pitching wildly, she rose to the seas with increasing restraint. The first light of dawn told why. The entire boat, above the waterline, was encased in ice, half a foot thick in places, and the rope to the sea anchor had grown to the size of a man's thigh. Under the weight of it, she was riding at least 4 inches deeper, like a waterlogged derelict rather than a boat. Worsley immediately sent McCarthy to awaken Shackleton, who hurried aft. When he saw the situation, he ordered all hands called. Then he himself took a small axe and cautiously crawled forward. With extreme care, so as not to puncture the decking, he began to knock the ice away with the back side of the axe. Periodically, a wave burst against the boat and swept over him, but he kept at it for nearly 10 minutes while the others anxiously looked on. By then he was so stiff with cold that he could no longer trust his grip or balance. He crawled back into the cockpit, with the water dripping from his clothes and his beard frozen half stiff. He was shivering noticeably as he handed the axe to Worsley to continue the job, cautioning him to use extreme care while he was on the decking. And so each of them took his turn at chipping for as long as he could endure it, which was rarely more than 5 minutes. First they had to knock off enough ice to get a handhold and a place to put their knees. To stand up on that glassy, rolling deck would have been to commit suicide. for had a man fallen overboard, the others could never have got in the sea anchor and hoisted sail in time to rescue him. Below, Shackleton discovered that ice was forming even inside the cockpit. Long icicles hung from under the decking, and water in the bottom was very nearly frozen. He called for Crean, and together they managed to get the Primus stove alight in the hope that it would give off enough heat to warm the cockpit above the freezing point. Unless the water in the bottom could be thawed enough so it could be pumped out, there was danger that it would simply sink the boat under them. It took an hour of agonizing work on deck before they felt the Caird begin to regain her buoyancy. But they kept at it until they'd succeeded in getting rid of most of the ice, except a large chunk on the sea anchor line, which they simply could not risk attempting to reach. Shackleton then called them below to have some milk. They gathered around the stove, almost sick with cold. It seemed inconceivable that their numbed bodies could have given off any warmth, but apparently they did, for after a while the icicles under the decking began to melt and drip down onto them. Not long afterward, the water in the bottom had thawed enough so they could pump it out. The southwesterly gale screamed on, showing not the slightest sign of fatigue. The watches of that night were like a tally sheet of infinity. Every individual minute had to be noted, then lived through, and finally checked off. There was not even a crisis to relieve the tortured monotony. When at last, about 6 o'clock, the sky to the east began to brighten, they could see that once again the boat was carrying a dangerously heavy burden of ice. As soon as the light permitted, she had to be chipped clear again. Sometime after 9 o'clock, the wind eased ever so slightly. A few minutes later, the Caird rose to a particularly high sea, and just then she was struck by a breaking wave. The smallest quiver passed through her, and the wave rolled on. But this time, she didn't swing back up into the wind. The sea anchor was gone. There was a moment of confusion. Then they felt her roll sickeningly to starboard, and she fell off into the trough of the sea, and they knew instinctively what had happened. Both Shackleton and Worsley scrambled to their feet and looked forward. The frayed end of the bow line was dragging through the water. The lump of ice was gone, and the sea anchor with it. Shackleton thrust his head below and shouted for the others to get the jib. They hauled it out, frozen into a rumpled mass. Crean and McCarthy crept forward over the heavily rolling deck, dragging the sail with them. The rigging, too, was frozen and had to be beaten into compliance. But after a long minute or two, they got enough ice off the halyards to hoist the jib to the mainmast as a storm trysail. Slowly, grudgingly, the Caird's bow once more swung around into the wind, and all of them felt the tension go out of their muscles. The job of the helmsman now was to hold her as close to the wind as she would go, swinging from one tack to the other. It required constant vigilance, and it could hardly have been more unpleasant, facing into the breaking seas and the piercing wind. Fortunately, the gale continued to diminish, and by 11 o'clock Shackleton decided to risk hoisting sail. The jib was removed from the main mast, and the reefed lugsail and mizzen were run up. Then, for the first time in 44 hours, the Caird was under way again toward the northeast, and the journey was resumed. But it was a slovenly course, with the boat running before the enormous following sea, her bow half buried by the force of the wind astern. Throughout the afternoon and evening, the weather gradually grew less violent, and by dawn on May the 3rd, the wind had fallen off to a moderate southwesterly breeze. As noon approached, the clouds started to thin out. Before long, patches of blue sky appeared, and soon the sun was shining down. Worsley took out his sextant, and it was no task at all to get a sight. When he had worked it out, the Fix put their position at 403 miles from Elephant Island. They were just more than halfway to South Georgia. Thus, in the space of only an hour, or maybe a little more, the outlook on board the Caird was completely altered. The battle was half won, and a warm sun was overhead. The off-duty watch no longer huddled in the dismal confines of the forecastle. Instead, the sleeping bags were hauled out and run up the mast to dry. The men peeled off various articles of clothing, and boots, socks, and sweaters were tied onto the shrouds and backstay. the sight that the cairn presented was one of the most incongruous imaginable. Here was a patched and battered 22-foot boat, daring to sail alone across the world's most tempestuous sea, her rigging festooned with a threadbare collection of clothing and half-rotten sleeping bags. Her crew consisted of 6 men whose faces were black with caked soot and half-hidden by matted beards, whose bodies were dead white from constant soaking in salt water. In addition, their faces, and particularly their fingers, were marked with ugly round patches of missing skin, where frostbites had eaten into their flesh. Their legs, from the knees down, were chafed and raw from the countless punishing trips crawling across the rocks in the bottom, and all of them were afflicted with salt water boils on their wrists, ankles, and buttocks. But had someone unexpectedly come upon this bizarre scene, undoubtedly the most striking thing would have been the attitude of the men. Relaxed, even faintly jovial, almost as if they were on an outing of some sort. By evening the sun had done a wonderful job of drying, and when they crawled into their sleeping bags that night, the sensation was distinctly pleasant, at least by comparison. The good weather held throughout the night and into the following day, May the 4th. Among the entire crew, there was a growing feeling of confidence, subtle but unmistakable. In the beginning, South Georgia had existed only as a name, infinitely distant and lacking in reality. But no more. They were less than 250 miles from the nearest point on South Georgia, and having already covered 450 miles, the distance that remained was at least conceivable. 3 days more, or maybe 4 at the most, should see them there. And then it would all be over. And so that peculiar brand of anxiety, born of an impossible goal that somehow comes within reach, began to infect them. Nothing overt, really, just a sort of added awareness. A little more caution and more care, to ensure that nothing preventable should go wrong now.
End of Disc 4.